welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics, current affairs, and other fun stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
Brandon, we've been off for a couple weeks because our late summer travel schedule seemed to kick in all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know you were traveling recently in Vegas. I was in California. I have a bunch of travel I'm trying to get in before kind of end of the year.
Do you have points or something? Or
I do. I mean, I have points. I have credits that go back to last year for flights that were canceled. So, yeah, just trying to balance it all. And
so you did get a credit, though, if you had a flight canceled sometime for COVID, I'm assuming.
I did. So I have Southwest credits for domestic flights. I actually have full flight reimbursement and then partial credit for an international flight I was supposed to go on for work back last year, which I'll have to use at some point. I know that particular credit I have, like, I think either a 2.5 or 3 year time frame to use. I need to go back and check. That's kind of where I'm at, just trying to get everything in.
I'm glad they're getting that credit. There's not some funky rule around that, like you have to use it within so many months of something or you don't get your money back or you don't
Do that. I mean, that was really good about anything that was during the pandemic last year. So anything that fell in 2020, I mean, they gave you like an automatic 2 year window. Now, anything booked this year that you would cancel is just whatever they're general policies are. So, you know, for Southwest, that's like 6 months or I don't know what that is, but that is a nice thing is that they were all pretty good to work with last year for cancellations.
I think as they should.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that's like a once in a lifetime event. I mean, it's completely out of everybody's control.
If like, you're not going to cancel out for this and give people a break for the pandemic, I guess there's no hope for anything. I got to go to Vegas last week. Joe was at an HR conference. So I got to tag along for a couple of days in Vegas, which are always fun.
Oh yeah. Can't go wrong in Vegas. I mean, if you're not a gambler, I mean, there's pools, you know,
I don't think I gambled a single cent when I was in Vegas because gambling just doesn't do it for me. But to your point, there's all kinds of stuff you can.
It's the entertainment capital of the world. Yeah, there's
a
everything.
Lot of people in Vegas making a lot of questionable decisions on a daily basis. And that's just so much fun to watch.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, I think, a deterrent for me for gambling. Like I may gamble like a couple bucks here and there, but nothing crazy because I look at the people around me that just go on and on or there for hours and hours. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's depressing.
In your mind, aren't you saying, I wonder what that person does for a living. How much money do they make? Because they seem to be losing a lot.
Right. I mean, especially the ones that are spending like thousands and thousands in just like an hour. And you're just like, what does this person do? Like,
and what does it do for them? That's what I don't get. I've never been energized by gambling. It's more of just, let's just lose my money, get this over with we can move on to something else. I've never been like, oh my God, we're going to go shoot craps. And I'm so excited about that. So
yeah, me neither. And I mean, especially too, because I think, you know, gambling is 24/7, like it never stops. Yeah. And so to me, it gets old fast. I'm like, you know, let's do this for a bit and I'm over it. I'm like, okay.
And of all of the addictions you could pick from, Brandon, gambling for me would be like one of the last ones I'd want to have.
Oh yeah. Cause you exhaust money so quickly. I mean, more so than almost any other addiction.
And it's a 24/7 thing. You're looking for what to bet. You're betting around the clock. Yeah. Gambling addiction just seems horrible.
Agreed.
So this week, while we were out vacationing and bringing the summer of 2021 to a glorious final close, President Biden said, hey, any company that employs over 100 people, we're going to go ahead and mandate the vaccine for them.
Yes. And so this was the big part of his announcement, right? Because a lot of people expected the mandate for federal workers and for federal contractors. So that wasn't surprising. But it was taking it several steps further with this mandate on private employers. And it not only is it pretty broad, there isn't any exception except, you know, the alternative is if you're not going to be vaccinated, you have to provide, those employees have to be tested weekly, COVID test in absence of being vaccinated. Yeah. So that's really that. And there's outside of that, there are no exceptions.
Well, and Brandon, this came from that historical wellspring of social policy, OSHA. which I didn't know OSHA had the power. This is the Office of Health and Safety for workplaces. I didn't know they had this kind of power. That it was weird to me where this emanated from, and that they were using right. OSHA as the agency to be able to deliver this mandate. Do you think these stand up to court challenges, or what is the future of this vaccine mandate?
So the mandate on private employers, it's a very, I think, challenging, and I think it's going to be very difficult for it to be upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. OSHA, for example, the rulemaking authority that was utilized for this, the last time there was a rule that was published was the 1980s in relation to asbestos. It was OSHA that basically mandated that, and again, I don't know the details, but about employers not being able to use that or having to retrofit asbestos related. But outside of that rule, there hasn't been one this significant,
yeah.
I mean, since the 1980s. And several of the other rules that OSHA has implemented for employers, they have kind of like a 50-50 track record. About half of them have been struck down and yeah. half have been upheld, let alone one that's as far-reaching as this and as controversial. So I think it remains to be seen. Now, if we talk about vaccine mandates at the state and local level, there is precedent for that.
Yeah,
there's a Supreme Court case from 1905 called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. There was a Lutheran minister who was originally from Sweden who sued because Massachusetts required the smallpox vaccine, and he didn't want to get vaccinated because as a child in Sweden, he had reactions to some other type of vaccine. So he fought the state and he refused to pay the fine. It was like a $5 fine in yeah. 1905. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that states and municipalities have the right to enact vaccine mandates and to enforce yeah. them. So that's been tested at the state and local level. But like again, like you said, this hasn't been tested at the federal level.
And states have a lot of leeway and a lot of power when it comes to mandating health related items for people in the state.
They do. And people
the local
forget
government
that. Yeah.
has even more.
Yeah.
So most of these mandates either come from the local level or the state level. This is also why the concept or the theory up to this point has been government is always best when it's the closest to people as it possibly can be.
Right. Local control.
And that concept seems to be another thing that's being deteriorated during this whole pandemic. We'll talk about that a little bit later with Texas and how local laws may be changing a little bit. But it certainly seems like this is the first time the federal government now is going to try to blanket mandate a vaccine for somebody. Is anything about you nervous, skittish about the federal government once again laying claim to a power that they've never had?
Yes, and I will say I understand the rationale for it and the desire to do it and to the frustration with how we've been stubbornly at like 52-53%
yeah,
vaccination.
It's not going up.
But at the same time, this is such a significant step forward, and I do worry about the precedent it sets, that if the federal government could step in and mandate that employers with 100 or more employees have to require this vaccination, what's to say that can't be utilized in other areas of public health and other requirements that are layered on? Because if all it takes is for the government to say we're going to have OSHA issue this rule yeah. and we're going to say this is a health or a workplace health and safety issue, well, you can say many things are health and safety issues in the workplace.
I ask again, what is the limiting principle now on the government using a department like OSHA to be able to introduce all kinds of intrusive regulations into your life under the guise of this is around keeping people safe at work?
Well, and it fails to acknowledge, like, I mean, and I get it, it's overly broad, so there's no differentiation between type of business or employees. What about companies that are 100% remotely distributed or
that's
don't have
point.
Offices? Like, and so there isn't that element of coming into contact with fellow employees anyway. But there's no exception or exemption for them under this law. It still applies. And then, how do they go about enforcing that? And how would you do? I mean, I guess they could pay and have COVID tests sent in the mail and then have the results sent back. But there's a lot of layers to this as well, bureaucratically, that I think can make it a nightmare as far as implementation. It would be interesting to see. So the question is, like, I think that there's probably a 50-50 chance that it gets struck down by the U.S. Supreme Supreme Court.
I think so.
The question is, up until that point, how many companies attempt to implement this and comply, and how close do we get to achieving a higher vaccination rate just by virtue of this happening and sending a signal to companies that the federal government is serious about this?
Many, many times in history, things go straight in the shitter when somebody says, I don't know what to do, but we have to do something.
We have to do something, yeah.
It feels a little bit like everybody's sitting around saying, we can't get off this 53% schneid. We've been sitting there with about 53% of the population currently vaccinated for quite some time. We have to do something. You're the president of the United States, Brandon. Is this what you choose to do? Do you choose to do anything? Was this the best play Biden could make?
I don't think so. I think the problem, too, with this is that it, at a time when we already see examples of, in some of these hard-hit communities, where people are finally starting to change opinions and just, you know, very quietly get vaccinated and, you know, come to terms with how serious and severe this virus is, I think it's going to halt that momentum and it's going to cause some backlash. And we're going to see some people who may have started to be open to getting vaccinated now not be open to the idea because they feel like this is such a heavy-handed approach.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, well, the government is forcing this. You know, there's something awry here. And so the problem is it plays into the hands of the conspiracy theorists and those that have an axe to grind, because, you know, this time they can say, oh yeah, the government is forcing you to. They've attempted to say that all along, but the matter of fact has been that there has been no government mandate to get vaccinated. It's all been a public pressure campaign. And I think there's a lot in that public pressure toolkit that we haven't utilized.
I agree. I mean, I look at it this way. If not this, what?
What about the carrot and stick approach? What if you incentivized large companies to require their employees to get vaccinated through tax credits or other types of...
Offer a tax credit if 95% of your employees get vaxxed or something.
And do the same thing with insurance companies, like convene a roundtable of the major insurers and talk about how you're going to incentivize them to require vaccination, like lower rates versus higher rates, fees. I mean, there's so much that you can do to that and to, I think, incentivize without going just immediately to mandates.
I think if I were president, what I would say is, hey, we're going to mandate this at the end of the year if we can't get to where we need to be.
Yeah.
And I just tell people.
More as kind of a threat. Yeah.
As a threat. And then to your point, where are the adults, the Democrats? You can't say this. I'm air quoting adults. Where are the adults in the approach that what would it take to get Trump on stage with Biden? Biden gives three lines of praise about the Trump vaccine and how great it is. You let Trump babble for 10 minutes and ends it with everybody go out and get a shot.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's likely to happen at all. I mean, Trump.
I know
we could even get Trump on stage for 9/11 with the former.
There
presidents.
Are things. Remember, like when Hurricane was it Sandy hit New York, and they had that huge celebrity call-a-thon. Where they why aren't we doing that? Why hasn't the Democrats reached over to people that don't speak the Democrat language, aren't part of the Democrat team, almost speak in terms that we don't understand to a group of people that we really don't want to talk to? Why don't we reach out to some of those folks and say, what would it take to get you to do some things to help move the vaccine?
Or enlist somebody like Governor Jim Justice of West Virginia, who's a Republican, but he's been a powerful advocate for vaccines. I don't know if you saw his soundbite last week where he was like, get the darn vaccine, you know, paraphrasing.
Yeah.
So enlist him in some type of like nationwide ad buy commercial that's targeted, you know, to people in rural areas on why this is critical or the states where it's going to play well and have an impact. But yeah, he would be an example of somebody you would want to get involved in something like that. Families of, you know, some of these radio hosts, you know, who have died, who are like,
there's
you
tons
know, get
of
this.
People out there.
There's so much you could do. I mean, you could create a national campaign that is targeted to the people who need to hear it with the message. Because the problem is they're not going to listen to, you know, national Democratic leaders, but they will listen to people that sound and look like them and talk like them who are parroting that message.
So the next time somebody says, we need a business person in the presidency. Here's what I hear when somebody says that. Because as a business person, you and I have been involved with projects where for some reason, every time Brandon hears me say it, he doesn't He doesn't listen to it. He doesn't get it. But Bob can say it, and he immediately connects with him. We've all had those issues.
Yeah.
And under the guise of a businessman gets things done, you pivot to whatever it takes to get the job done. And it feels like the Biden administration was not worth to eat some crow, you know, go out, put the work in to make those contacts, in some ways elevating some of these people so there would be a political price to pay. But they weren't willing to do any of that, and they went right to the mandate.
And I think that's the problem. You're not going to get everybody, right? There's always going to be holdouts. We know that. Even, you know, the people that booed Trump, you know, at his rally a couple weeks ago when he talked about getting vaccinated. Yeah. But there is probably a 10 to 20% of those holdouts that can be moved. And if we can increase the vaccination rate from 53 to 63%, or closer to 70%, that's a huge win. You know, we're not going to get close to 100%. There will always be that 25 to 30%. But, you know, it's about getting to herd immunity status, and we have to have more than 52% to get there.
So what do you, how do you respond to the people that say, I agree, we need to hit like 75 or 80% to get to herd immunity? Why is it that the numbers of people who have natural immunity based off having the virus, why are those never counted? And I think there's some legitimacy to that. But just tactically, how do you get 200 million, 100 million people who've had COVID, how do you get them to get the antibodies test?
Right. I mean, so that's part of it. And I don't know what number we're up to now in terms of the percentage of the population who have actually had COVID and have that natural immunity. Yeah. I think we're somewhere in the ballpark of what, between 15 and 20% now
that have had COVID?
That have had COVID.
Yeah, I think we're up to like 25% of folks that have had COVID.
So we have those. And I do think there's a lot to be said for natural immunity. They're still doing the test to figure out how long that lasts and whether or not natural immunity holds up against the variants and the latest variants. But no, there is a lot to be said for that. And so that should be included. I would argue that, you know, having had COVID shouldn't preclude you from getting vaccinated because, A, we don't know if you can get it again or not. And B, vaccination in and of itself helps prevent the spread of variants. I mean, we know that variants can still spread within a population that's recovered. So more people that get vaccinated help prevent the spread of variants in addition to reducing symptoms. And so it's smart from that standpoint.
And isn't there a lane there that it seems like Biden's ignoring too?
Yeah.
Telling people, I get it. A lot of us have had COVID. You think you've got the natural variant. Here's our, the natural immunity. Here's why we're not pressing on that. Number one, don't you have to pay to get that, the antibody test?
You do. You have, and I think it's out of pocket. Yeah. I don't it think is. Insurance covers
so
it at all.
Right there. So. Nobody's going to go
nobody's
get it tested.
Nobody's
going to do it. Yeah. It would take too long and be way too much money to spin up a testing infrastructure for that, which we don't have. And the quickest viable path is still the vaccine.
Right.
I think what the approach they're taking is, everything they mention other than the vaccine and going to get the vaccine, I think they feel like it gives, they're putting one more excuse out into the ether for somebody to say, okay, that's why I'm not going to do it.
Well, and the problem is it's a more nuanced message, but
it is
an absence of having that message. It allows for confusion to spread. And I think there's just, they're not in control of that. And I think they're unwilling to wade into those details. But the problem is then the narrative gets written by everybody else.
I think you just said it right there. They're not in control of that. They know that. And they know there's no way to get any type of accurate reporting. And it's just, it's probably a slower path than just forcing everybody to get the vaccination.
Yeah.
Which
I think you're right.
I mean, I don't envy the Biden team's position in this. I still think there's some levers they could have pressed, but it felt like we were going to get here sooner or later. Let's just push the button and let's just have the fight now instead of later.
Right.
I don't see any way this whole conversation can be avoided.
I agree. I do think, I mean, if they would have engaged, I think, on the health insurance side and like the airlines, I mean, those are two avenues where, you know, if you have those large companies implement mandates, then that would quickly get people to change habits and behavior because people want to fly. And
So let's role play this out a little bit. Let's say a month from now, this gets shot down and it never gets implemented. Does Biden come back and try something else, or does it die here?
I think he'll probably try something else. I mean, something that's much less.
What's left?
Well, I mean, I think he's going to be resigned to, again, I don't think anything legally, right? I mean, he's not going to be able to do anything that's on the level of a mandate because, yeah. I mean, this is really the only option. It's as strong as you can go. If this gets struck down, there's nothing left to pick up the pieces other than just trying to work with private industry and get them to implement these mandates on their own. Otherwise, because I don't see a pathway for the government to
I think he's done at this point. I mean, if you're not willing to do the reach across the aisle where you're promoting your enemy as a source of information to a group of people that don't want to hear from you, if you're not going to do that, you've got one trick. You've got the mandate and that's it. And once that either falls apart or doesn't get implemented, it feels like the government, the Biden administration is out of juice at that point in time.
Yeah. I mean, then you're just basically at, you know, carrot and stick approaches of like, tax credits and incentivizing business, which is slow and does it. I mean, it's not going to have the same momentum and payoff that you would have.
Or are we done? Well, do we just say we've done everything we can do
and just leave it at that?
I mean, my God, people, we produced a goddamn miracle drug for you. And you didn't want that.
No, but they'll take horse dewormer.
Correct. And yeah. Correct. You'll shoot horse.
Calls the poison hotline spiking.
And ivermectin, yes, is a drug.
It is
prescribed by doctors to humans all the time. The problem is the human doesn't want to go to the doctor. They grab the tube or the pill of horse wormer.
They take the amount that's for a horse.
Yeah.
And then they get poisoned.
Yeah. Instead of taking the drug we developed for, that's crazy.
It's this tendency, and I just don't understand this logic of, you know, we have something that's been tested that has, you know, probably the best efficacy of any modern vaccine that we have available today. And you can't even quibble with the amount of testing because you've had, you know, half the country taken now.
Half
you're
the
talking
world's
about 150
taken it.
Million. Yeah, half the world. But yet we're not going to do that because, you know, we don't know what we're putting inside our bodies, but we'll put everything else under the sun and try everything else that we don't know. Because
you look at another human and say, well, I want to know what goes in my body. That other human should just punch you straight in the face.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what they're putting in
their
body.
I mean, half the stuff we drink and eat and consume every day, we don't know what's in it.
Are you kidding? Yeah. I love it when somebody says, well, I want the Pfizer shot instead of the Moderna. Why? Well, I trust it more. Why? Did you mix it up? Do you know what's in it?
Yeah.
I think what this shows is we've even those arguments that in some ways held ground maybe in the past, they've all fallen away in the fact that we're in a pandemic. I don't want to put what I don't know in my body. That all goes to hell when people start dying around you.
I mean, it's when you have, you know, close to 650,000 dead, which actually we're close now to approaching the estimated number of dead from the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic in the U.S. So that shows you where we're at as a country, which is scary to think.
So for me, I thought the pandemic would be over when the vaccines came out. I thought by July 4th, we'd hit close to that 80% fully vaccinated, call it good, party, we're all good to go.
Yeah.
Obviously, that didn't happen. Brandon, what is the date now that the pandemic ends?
And we don't have a date, right? I mean, and there are no policymakers don't seem to have a timeline or date. And so we're just kind of stuck in neutral. And I think that's what's so frustrating too, because it's like, at what point do you just throw up your arms and be like, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing left to do, because this is largely a pandemic of the unvaccinated now. And I think to all of us who got vaccinated and followed the rules, it's frustrating to have to still operate under the requirements, you know, that the unvaccinated should be under.
Yeah.
So, you know, and operate under the social distancing and all of this when, you know, we know what works. We've done our part, and there's a segment of the population that has not. And so everybody else is having to pay for that.
Biden caught some grief this week, as he should, that he didn't really kind of nuance that approach that you just laid out. He just laid it out there. I'm doing this because you people won't take the vaccine.
Yeah.
There's about half the people in the country. I can't figure you out. This is your fault. You're the ones that are causing us to do this. So therefore, it's mandated. Did you do you agree that he could have done that better? And is that just one more kind of log on the bad messaging on COVID all the way around?
It is. I think number one, I think what was striking to me is he should have had Dr. Fauci there or a medical team to provide that reinforcement. I get that this is a policy decision, but he could have had Dr. Fauci and the scientists and the epidemiologists there to get into the specifics of why we need higher vaccination, what herd immunity is, why the vaccine matters for herd immunity. I think there's a case to be made for that, that Biden can't make that case because he's a politician. True. And so you have
Fauci make that case now.
Well, I mean, I don't know, but I mean, he's the only non-policymaker that has still that level of gravitas. So it's better than nothing. But I think having him, you know, director of the CDC there, so I thought that was what was missing, because I think absent of that, it's just all a political speech. And I think there would have been value in talking about where we are now in the pandemic, where we're going, why we need to do this. And the big thing is, I think, recognizing, you know, hey, it's frustrating. The reason that all of us are still having to operate with mask and distance and all of this is, even if we're vaccinated, is because we have to account for the unvaccinated now filling up the hospitals. And the fact of the matter is, we have hospital ICUs in different parts of the country that are filling up so rapidly that they are having to turn away people for other injuries and
cancer,
people that need
patients,
cancer treatment.
Surgeries.
So yeah, that's where we're at. If this had no effect on the rest of us, then it would be one thing. But the fact of the matter is that the unvaccinated, they're not only impacting themselves, and I'd like to talk about it as if it's only themselves that are being impacted.
It's not.
It's everybody.
Yeah, this is a great point. This is not just a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Right.
They may be getting sicker and going to the hospital at a higher rate,
but they are taking hospital beds from other people who need them.
Absolutely. And if you can't drive that through to somebody, that you may be taking a hospital bed, that somebody who has cancer or somebody actually needs, if that doesn't persuade you to do it, I don't know what argument is left that can be. Brandon, I'm sitting here thinking, people pay you to help them communicate. In a sense, that's your job. And your specialty is communicating online. Why? How are we so bad at this? We've beaten this horse hundreds of times under Trump. Trump was just devolved into a comedy show, a tragic comedy show, but still a comedy show. We all had high expectations for Biden, seemed to start off good. I think we both agree, has not delivered in that area.
Flattered.
How do we get to this place? I guess my question is, you've been on the staff of a senator. Does somebody take like normal, straightforward communication that every American can understand and go through it and like highlight stuff out, change words, give you notes like make this more confusing? This makes too much sense. Don't say this. People might actually know what you mean. I guess my question is, give me some insight. How does this level of communication or lack of there just keep perpetuating on itself? Doesn't somebody eventually stand up, raise their hand and say, I'm sorry, guys, but nobody knows what we're doing here.
Right. There should be, right? So, and having worked for a senator, I can say there's a lot of redlining that happens, especially when policy declarations
are
made.
So you can confirm that somebody looks at it and says,
oh, not just somebody, like multiple layers of people. Yeah. And before it gets down to, you know, the president or the senator or the office holder, because that person will often then be the final point of review and often do their own redlining and consultation. Yeah. And it'll be this constant give and take. So yes, I mean, that should be part of what's common review process for policy declarations and speeches. I mean, that shouldn't be controversial at all.
So Senator Moran has somebody who heads up his policy work, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that man or woman, they're really interested in what communications go out, and they really want to look and make sure things
absolutely
are being communicated. It's just fascinating.
And I mean, even things as simple as when the senator was giving a speech to the local chamber of commerce on the economy and economic indicators, that would be reviewed by multiple people, multiple places. And if it was somebody like me, accompanying the senator and staffing him on that event, I would help review that in addition to the senator himself. So even at that level, if you know that there's that oversight that's happening and that type of a QA review process, then you have to imagine what it's like at the presidential level. So it does beg the question, like, who and what is going on and why, you know, and we saw this not just with COVID and the pandemic, but obviously what happened in Afghanistan, that was a communication failure of the highest degree.
Absolutely. I thought Biden would get more into the he would develop the modern age kind of fireside chat.
Yeah.
I thought a lot of his presidency in the first year would be him just looking at a camera, just saying, here's what's going on. I just wanted to make sure everybody's
involved.
Because
he did very well in those kind of fireside chat style town halls.
Yeah.
Like they were televised during the campaign.
Yeah. Now the media has to help him out a little bit because he's not as sharp and as fast, but we all get that.
But something to that degree.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought we'd see one of those a week and he would kind of lay out the parameters of what we're doing. I have to say, it's been very disappointing watching the Biden team try to get their shit together when it comes to message this and just fail time and time and time again.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess the only thing I'm interested in the pandemic anymore is when does it end? How? How is this thing coming to a close? And I was pretty sure we would be done with this by midsummer.
Right.
It feels like we're gearing up for another fight this winter as people start going back indoors. We're still having 12 to 1400 people a day die of COVID. It feels like we're going to be better than we were last winter, but certainly repeat on some scale of what happened last year.
Right. And I think that, I mean, part of that is inevitable. I mean, as you know, I think what's different than last year is we have no vestiges left of the shutdown or lockdown that's happening. So and generally there's free movement. Everything's open back up. And when you still have half of the population hasn't been vaccinated, you know, that free movement is going to cause the virus to circulate and we're going to see, you know, the impact of that. So it all goes back to people taking the initiative and getting vaccinated. If they're refusing to do so, then, you know, this is going to last. We're going to eventually get to a point where we're going to see this COVID flare up in pockets. It'll just be sporadic communities across the country where we see it higher depending on vaccination rates in those communities. And then it'll gradually flicker out. If you look at past pandemics, that's typically how they've ended in absence of a vaccine. So, you know, we have a vaccine here, but for all intents and purposes, we should... It's almost like, you know, we only have a partial vaccine because we have so many people that still haven't been vaccinated. So in many parts of the country, you know, it's almost as if you have no vaccine at all. A good example is Carter County in the Ozarks region of Missouri. So they have a 27% vaccination rate there only.
Sounds about right.
So they have right now a 34% positivity rate, COVID positivity rate.
That's frighteningly high.
And their hospitals are full. And there was a CNN did a segment on this and they went to that county and interviewed people and, you know, almost everybody knows somebody who's either been hospitalized now or who has died from it, which is startling.
I always tell people that my definition for adulthood, how do you know you're an adult? You know you're an adult when you consistently do things you don't want to do because you have to.
Right.
You have to make a living. You've got to pay a bill. You've got rent to. I got to go to work. It feels like for this pandemic to end, a bunch of people are going to have to do things they don't want to do.
But see, part of the problem, Craig, is we're in this cultural state now in America where...
That don't fly.
Yeah, no, we don't want to be inconvenienced at all for anything. And so, you know, we fight back and we make a scene and make a ruckus. And I mean, you see this every day with airline behavior now, which is just at its worst, which is why you have, you know, flight attendants that are quitting en masse because they don't want to deal with it anymore. You see it at restaurants and in public venues where, I mean, just the slightest requirement, slightest modicum of consideration. And that includes masking, but it doesn't have to be masking. Anything at all, people just get irate because they don't want to be inconvenienced.
And that's what the pandemic's taken from us.
Yeah.
Our patience, any type of ability to listen to anybody else and understand that they're having a bad day too. The understanding that it's just an inconvenience. It's not an attack on your freedom.
Right.
It's not an assault on who you are as an individual. It's a minor inconvenience because this big giant thing has happened. But at some point, some population's going to have to bite down and do something they don't want to do.
Yes.
And it feels like it's a contest between 47% of the people in the United States and the Biden administration.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Biden administration is going to win this. They're going to have to be an adult, do something they don't want to do, and find a way to work with people on the right to get people to get shots in arms.
Yeah. That's ultimately what it's going to come down to.
Duh. Let's talk about more adults and doing things you don't want. I guess we're going to Texas next, where they've had themselves quite the past couple of weeks.
Yeah. So this abortion law, which so lawmakers in Texas thought they were pretty creative in writing this law.
I heard somebody describe this as this was a pick designed for a specific lock.
Yeah.
This law only does one thing. It was designed to do one thing, and that's it.
Well, and I think by taking the enforcement provisions off of the lawmakers themselves, I mean, what they thought they were doing is that they were creating a law that could not be opposed or adjudicated because, you know, they were not running afoul of, you know, existing Supreme Court precedent like Roe v. Wade because yeah. of the way that this law operates and as the functionality of it, because essentially what this does is it deputizes individual citizens to report on others and to sue in a court of law and be rewarded for those lawsuits monetarily.
Like $10K.
Yeah. Well, $20K, I think. Yeah, it's $20K.
And it's paid by the person they're suing.
Right.
You're paying that person.
So it's just it's so wrong on so many accords, but least of all because you're monetarily incentivizing somebody to bring forward a lawsuit. And it's not the way, I mean, it's something, it's akin to like Wild West in terms of how you would, it's not the way you should run policy at all. I mean, that's not, and again, the whole point, if you are confident in the policy decisions you're making, you should be able to be the enforcement mechanism for that. And so, I mean, basically the state is offloading enforcement to just anybody and everybody individually and saying, oh, hey, it's up to you. We're going to be off the hook because that makes us off the hook in terms of legal challenges. And, you know, it creates an environment where, it, you know, not only does it, I think there's a lot of issues with turning in citizens and doing that, but you're also, you have people that are incidental to the process, you know, Uber drivers, those who have
that abated, helped that woman get an abortion be targeted.
They can be targeted and they can be sued. So they can be a defendant in a lawsuit, which is also scary and something that should have happened, let alone the fact that the people that are bringing the lawsuits have no damages directly, right?
No,
I mean, they are not connected at all. It can be just anybody who thinks they know of somebody who's had an abortion. And so, yeah, the lack of legal standing, I think, is really what's crazy to me.
This law just lays to waste several core principles of the legal system that we've operated on since day one, with the first one being standing. You have to have a reason to sue somebody. If Brandon gets hit by a car, I can't sue the person that hit Brandon.
Right.
Because I didn't suffer the injury. Brandon or Brandon's family or someone that depends on Brandon for income, they have standing. They have a case. This basically just says any citizen can file a lawsuit against any other citizen that they feel has had an abortion after 6 weeks. So basically what the state of Texas did is they created a new law, or that they wrote a new statute in a traditional way. Hey, after 6 weeks, it is illegal for a woman in the state of Texas to get an abortion. That's a standard statutory law.
Yeah.
But what they did, to your point, they removed the state's enforcement. There is no state agency that is responsible for enforcing this law.
No.
There's no one to call. There's nobody to say, hey, I'm going to get in touch with this agency, this department, and they're going to take a step.
No, they essentially outsourced enforcement to the public.
They did. And so what this does is basically, because there's no person, they get around this because there's no person to sue. If somebody said, I'm going to sue this person or this, I'm going to sue this government agency because they are not protecting the right of this person to have or not to have this medical procedure. When you eliminate that, they basically have said it's a civil process now between two parties. That's insane.
Yeah.
So think of it this way. The government is saying that a woman has a constitutional right to an abortion. We just simply are not going to enforce that. The government here is making a choice not to enforce or not to guarantee a right that is in the Constitution. That's a very weird unprecedented and weird thing to do. But there is some precedence for this. We talked about the American with Civil Disabilities Act.
The ADA. American with Disabilities Act.
Sarah Isger for the Dispatch. She ran a DOJ department and was a Supreme Court clerk or something. In one of their podcasts, she ran through that the legal basis for this is the American with Disabilities Act. There is no department that enforces the American with Disabilities Act. It is a private action between somebody who has a disability and the owner of a business. Right. So basically what they did is said, you have a person who is disabled has a constitutional right to enter into a public space or a business. But we, because the size and scope of this problem is so widespread and goes so deep, there's no possible way we could create a government agency to enforce or protect that. What would the enforcement wing of the ADA look like?
It would be massive.
You would be bigger than the FBI and the IRS combined, right. And you still wouldn't get anything done. So they said, hey, but we will give somebody the right to sue a private business if they don't have access to their business because of their disability. So that was kind of the legal precedent or framework they used to put this law together.
Right, but the glaring flaw is that those people are directly damaged. They have damages they can prove. And this is allowing people that have no direct or indirect damages that they can prove to just come forward and launch a lawsuit, which is crazy.
And their whole justification for this is at the end of the day, we're just trying to save human life. We're just trying to save babies. What is it against, Brandon, what do you have against babies? Why are you so anti-baby that you hate this law? That's not the point at all.
Yeah, not at all.
The point is Texas is trying to get ultra creative in combining like five different legal concepts together while destroying one of our core legal concepts, which is standing. If you weren't directly harmed, you have no case.
If this proves to go forward, I mean, basically the idea of standing gets thrown out the window.
It's gone.
Think about how many aspects of policy that would impact.
This law to me is peak 2021.
Yeah.
I just want to get in somebody else's business over something that I feel strongly about. And I just want to inject my rights into somebody else's situation. To me, I mean, this is, you could call this like the first Instagram law or the first social media framework law. Why is it that a private citizen in Texas can basically start a civil suit against you because they think something happened? What's more 15-year-old high school girl than that?
Yeah.
I mean, Brandon, your side of the fence has been talking about all this woke bullshit and this is bad. And then you guys go and pull, to me, if you're afraid of woke culture, there's no greater example of it than this Texas law.
I mean, this accelerates it.
This takes it out of the informal and out of the social media and codifies it into a legal approach.
Well, and conservatives should be worried.
This is
because
crazy.
If this becomes precedent, it can be used and weaponized by the left in similar ways, right? I mean, when it comes to guns,
again,
when it comes to
what's
other policy
the limiting
areas?
Principle here? You're doing something I don't like. I'm going to take a civil action.
Yeah.
There's no limiting principle to it.
No.
This is the Republicans in Texas trying to out-clever themselves. This is the Republicans. This is what I don't get about this law. So when the Supreme Court goes into session next, I think it's Dobson versus Mississippi.
Yeah, that's the next abortion case.
There's an abortion case. This drives me nuts, too. It's not Roe that currently is that we are regulating abortion under. It's Casey versus Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Casey versus Planned Parenthood in 96 or something like that. That came up with the undue burden, where you could not put a woman through an undue burden to get an abortion. And it also came up with the term viability. That's what opened the door to all of these heartbeat bills that passed in the state. I'm becoming more and more convinced that abortion needs to be, the Supreme Court just says it's legal, it's a state issue. Because we're nationalizing this issue and we're radicalizing people over something they have no ability to change. And is that a good thing? Why should somebody in Missouri, why should my wife be incredibly upset? And she has every right to be about this law in Texas. We're creating something that's causing more tension and causing more to become more destable than what we need to be. I think what's getting everybody ginned up now is everybody wants to be involved in everything and have something to say about everything.
Right.
We just need to push kind of abortion out of the federal case, out of the federal level, where everybody's looking for one overarching decision that allows them to win, and push it back down to the states and just tell people this entire country,
which is where it started.
Yeah. This entire country is set up that if you don't like where you're living, move, go to where people think like you, vote with your feet.
I mean, it is amazing because we're 48 years
post Roe v. Wade,
you know, and we're still having this debate, but now it's gone in this completely different direction with the Texas law.
And tell me too, why do 9 unelected people, why is the Supreme Court making up parameters for abortion? That makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah.
Why is the Supreme Court defining what viability of a fetus is? That's ridiculous. This is the time. This is the time for the Supreme Court to come out and say, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is a state's issue. It really always has been a state's issue. And if you don't like it, maybe you need to decide what state you live in.
Well, is it that the thinking behind the Mississippi case? So if they rule in the affirmative for that case, then that would make it a state's issue again. It goes, it really just
pretty
goes
much
back. Even with Roe v. Wade.
I mean, yeah, Roe v. Wade is somewhat irrelevant. Yeah. Everybody agrees that, at least conceptually, that it's constitutional.
Right.
So I don't, and people know that that's a much harder thing to go after.
Right.
Because most people who follow law say Roe v. Wade as a legal decision is a massive piece of shit. Doesn't have much legal precedent to it and can be unwound pretty easily. I don't think that's where we're going after. What we're going after is what is viability and what is undue burden.
Yeah.
And we're never going to agree on that.
No,
never.
Not going to happen.
This is one of those. Put that decision as close to the local population as you can. Let them make their own law. And then that way you don't have to constantly be expending energy over what some state just did. I don't care what Texas did. If you don't like that abortion law and you live in Texas, move. This isn't communist Russia.
Well, and we always go back to the fact, I mean, most people are in the middle on abortion. Like, they think it should be legal, but rare. They think there should be parameters
legal,
around
rare.
It. You know, there should be abortion on demand, that it should be regulated, but it should be accessible. And so we have these battles that are between each extreme, like outlaw abortion, keep it legal. But that's not where most Americans are at. And, you know, and I think that the danger and the damage that the Texas law does is it, again, I think, takes anybody who might be somewhat in that kind of moderate middle, and it takes the issue completely to the extreme.
Well, take the word abortion out of it and replace it with any other word, and it makes the law sound as ridiculous as it is.
And that's what's
just
so bad about this law.
Take the word abortion out. If I see Brandon eating ice cream, I sue him. If I see Brandon fill in anything other than the word abortion,
well, it's just completely insane. Yeah.
I can't. What gets me so fired up about this law is if you follow the through line to, one, we want the courts to decide everything, which is ridiculous and is a pattern that just keeps getting worse and worse. And now, peak 2021, I'm involved in everything. I have a right to know everything. Isn't Roe v. Wade is an extension of privacy rights, isn't it?
Yeah. That was the basis for it, was an inherent right to privacy.
So now we're saying if I think Brandon took his girlfriend to get an abortion, I can sue him. I can force him to get a lawyer. I can at least force him to respond. That's insane. It's crazy. This law's got to get struck down. I do understand the Supreme Court saying, let's work something through so we've got some clay to work with. But to me, that law is just every single person who's elected, who's involved with that law, needs to be impeached and thrown out immediately.
Yeah.
Starting with Abbott, going all the way down.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
So have we entered the point now where at the state level, and I'm thinking about DeSantis here and all the bullshit that he's tried to pull around COVID. Are we coming up with like designer political laws now? What are we? We've talked a lot about theater, and a lot of this is just
performative
for show.
Politics. Yeah, I mean,
we've moved past that, Brandon. This ain't for show anymore.
No,
I mean, now they're taking this and enacting law out of it. DeSantis is doing not the abortion thing, but his own stupidity in Florida, where he's moved out of just the performative I'm going to, and he's actually making laws that are grounded in no legal precedent at all. Well, does this just continue?
I think that's the difference, is you used to have conservatives would create what they called model legislation mm-hmm. that could be worked through the states. There were, and that legislation, even if you disagreed with it, at least had a legal underpinning. Like, it was crafted so that it could hold up constitutionally yes. and legally. And now they're just throwing that out the window and being like, we don't care. We're going to craft it however we want.
Who makes a law that targets a core, I mean, one of the pillars of the whole thing, and says, well, I'm just going to kick that out?
Yeah.
Who does that? Who does that? It's just, and what's Abbott's MO? Where's he going? He's not running for president. He's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
It's not going to fly. I say that now. Sanders had a heart attack. I thought that would kick him out, and it didn't. Abbott is as high on the chain as he can go. Who is he doing this for?
I don't understand it. Yeah.
Is he trying to hold off Matthew McConaughey with this law? This law's worth your job?
Well, I think it has the opposite effect. I think this law does so much damage to those who voted for it. I mean, it's completely unpopular.
I'm not a big fan of boycotts and when one state ends travel with the other one. Oh, I generally think that's pretty stupid. But here, I mean, I can see somebody's point by saying, I just don't want no part of that state. At the same time, as this abortion law went in, apparently I can just strap a gun on and walk around too. So I am voting with my feet. I'm never living, and I'll travel to Texas, maybe if business would require it, but that's about it. When do we start getting, but also too, I don't care. Let those people do what those people want to do.
Right.
If you want to walk around with a gun, what do I give a shit?
But see, I think the broader point is here, I would argue that most Texans aren't for this. At the very most, there's probably 50-50 split on this issue, but I think it's more so the other way. But it's an example of how Texas has a government. They have a legislature and a governor who are in power because of redistricting and because of what's the word I'm trying to...
Gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering. Thank you. I was losing that word. So they have this lock on the Texas legislature that Democrats can't break, despite the gains that they've made in inroads.
It's going to get worse.
And it's only going to get worse. And so a lot of this is reactionary to that, right? Because part of it is they see the demographic change, writing is on the wall. And the next election or the one after that, Texas is going to be voting blue at the presidential level.
You think 2024 is going to be a God knows what.
Well, yeah. But
you think 2028 under a normal election cycle?
Because Texas, Biden lost Texas by just a little bit over 5 points in 2020. And that's exactly where Georgia was in 2016. And then Georgia went blue in 2020. So you look at the parallels there. It's really fascinating because Texas is following that same trajectory. Donald Trump won Texas by 10 points initially in 2016, which was actually 9 points, 9 points, which was much less than Romney and McCain. And then he only won it by 5 in 2020. So you see where, you know, it's headed. And I think it parallels Georgia pretty well in terms of the vote. So I would argue that if it doesn't go blue by this next election, it's going to be very close.
I just don't know what to make of the demographics argument anymore, because I've made that argument for so long and I've been wrong so often, because my original demographic argument was the Republican Party should have been in the waistband by now. We should have been on the third iteration of whatever the Republican Party was trying to modernize itself to be. And that just hasn't happened. And as much of a disaster Trump was, he did get more votes than any other sitting president in the history of the country. Yeah.
I mean, and part of that was his ability to tap into voting communities that typically don't vote, infrequent voters. I mean, if you're talking about rural voters, and really be able to increase their voting rates, which has been to levels not seen before, as well as, you know, he was able to dabble enough in minority communities, just enough to make that claim. But again, the problem too, and why this makes the 2020 election so difficult to dissect, is at the same time he bled suburbanites. You know, yeah. He continued to lose urban voters, and that's the thing with Texas. Texas would have been even closer this time around, but there were Hispanic voters that Trump picked up, but he lost places like Dallas and Houston and Austin by levels unseen. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And that went further out into the suburbs and exurbs than ever before. I think a good example is the county that's home to Fort Worth, Tarrant County.
It sounds like it.
It went blue for the first time in over 60 years. I mean, you had to go back to Lyndon Johnson. So that is happening. And I think the question is, you know, this law may reverse the trend we've seen with tech companies moving to Texas, but the avalanche of tech companies relocating to Texas has also helped in that blue demographic.
I just say it again. If you're a state and you want to tell 50% of your population, this is the approach we're taking to women's health, so be it. I believe the market will straighten that out.
Market will dictate. And then eventually you'll see some of these states reverse course and, you know, you're going to see behavior change. But
I hate to tell Greg Abbott this, but men are abandoning college in record numbers.
Yeah.
The split right now from female to male, it's 60-40 from college.
Oh, yeah.
Moving women already are mostly doctors, and that delta is going to expand greatly over the next 20 years.
Yeah.
If you think it's good business to do this, knock yourself out. I just don't get to here's what I'm trying to piece together. What we talked about, the vaccine mandate and Abbott in Texas, aren't we talking about the exact same thing? Two political parties, two political leaders who refuse to talk to anybody except their base. And they just keep doubling down, tripling down, talking more, doing more things the base like. And they just never in any way are trying to expand who they're talking
to. I think on the Republican side, it's, I think, this recognition that we're going to lock in as much on the short term that we can, because we see, you know, where we're going. We know that we could lose all this, you know, in 5-10 years. And so get as much done as possible, lock it all in. So that's what it's all about.
That's traditional, I think, Republican thinking. Has Trump changed any of that? That doesn't have to be your fate if you just fight hard enough against it. Do you feel that has taken on any type of meaning and people don't feel that way anymore?
Then it's just, you know, the rhetoric. You just completely keep, you know, as long as you're seen as being in opposition.
You just keep fighting. You just keep doubling down. You never change your perspective. You never expand. I can't think of a single instance in the past, I don't know, number of years. Tell me about the last time you saw a politician try to increase their base. I can't think of it.
Yeah, I can't either.
I mean, Bill Clinton with the sister soldier moment, we're talking 90-something there. I can't think of the last time.
And a lot of that goes back to all of the gerrymandering that's been done, right? They don't have to increase the size of their base. So if you're in Congress, if you're in the House of Representatives, you know, it's only your base that matters. I mean, completely. You know, it's just that's where we've gone in this country. And, you know, so those trend lines have followed the political realignment from the gerrymandering that's occurred with redrawing of districts.
I mean, if the Supreme Court allows this law to pass, I would put this law under the kind of self-governed or the self-enforced category. Where's this going?
Well, I cannot fathom that it would be allowed to stand because, again, you just, the precedent that it sets, I mean, for everything, it's just, it's crazy. I mean, think about how clogged up the courts would get.
I don't know. I guess I get the Supreme Court's thing is, so it's not a burden issue, right? Because we're not saying, it has nothing in it that says they're reducing the number of clinics or stuff like that.
No, but it's designed that way, right? So the obvious intention is, you know, it's designed to force these clinics out of business so they won't have to deal with the lawsuits and, and the people that are, you know, impacted don't have to deal with lawsuits.
Brendan, I Googled this the other day. I bet you probably haven't Googled much on I think it's called RU486, the abortion bill.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, but the future of abortion is medical, the present of the abortions are medical. They're not clinical. Yeah. More abortions are being done every year by taking medicine than are done in a clinical setting.
Right.
So in some ways we're arguing about nothing, because how most abortions are having today are people are ordering medications off the internet that they're getting, or their doctor's prescribing them this pill. So in some ways, this is another massive performance.
Does this bill not impact
abortions in hospitals? I've read as much as I can, and I cannot figure out if this law has nothing. How is this law going to? Well, okay, the Texas law might, because I guess if you think a person ordered abortion medication online,
yeah, I didn't.
Can
think
you sue them now?
Right. I don't think the Texas law discriminated or specified.
I don't think it added medication
medicinal
in there.
Abortions. Yeah.
My point being is that the present and the future for abortion as a procedure is not going to be in a clinic. There's a lot of women right now who are ordering abortion pills online and doing this themselves.
That was happening during the pandemic last year. Yeah.
I am horrified to my core that happens, but I accept that it does. And I understand why, but this is another point. When are we ever going to really talk about where the future of abortion's going, what that means, and how are we going to, or are we going to try to get balls deep into regulating that too?
Right.
Because if I'm somebody whose abortion is my main issue in Texas, the clinics are one thing, but how do you go after the online? And if you'll adopt this law, you'll adopt any law, won't you? I mean, there's no limiting principle to what you will do at this point if you think this law is a good idea.
Well, I think the application of the precedents for this law to other cases, to guns, you know, if there's a mass shooting and you have other people that aren't impacted by that, but they want to sue the gun manufacturers, what's set to stop them? I mean, again, if you're going to open this up to parties without standing, I mean, it can apply to so many different cases.
That's the big one. How do you get a handle back on that?
Yeah.
Brandon, what's our third topic? I got too fired up over the Texas law.
So tomorrow is the recall election in California. End of night will be Pacific time, so it'll be very late. We'll know whether or not that recall was successful. Polling shows that Gavin Newsom has regained momentum and has double-digit lead and should be expected to come out victorious. I think the larger question, so Democrats will be able to breathe a sigh of relief. One of the big issues here was it just the narrative, right, of a Democratic governor in a heavily Democratic state getting beaten by a Trump Republican, but also the possibility that something could happen to Dianne Feinstein, who's like 89 or 91 or something up there.
Old as dirt.
Very old, senile. And she could be replaced by the Republican governor with a Republican senator and change the balance of the Senate completely. So that was a scary possibility. That doesn't look like it's going to happen now, but I think what this means for our democracy is we're already seeing the narrative that was used by Trump replicated here in the California recall, with Republicans already saying that the election was rigged, that there was fraud, and that's the only way the Democrats are going to win. So again, this is destructive to our democracy to see this tactic and to see it weaponized the way it is over and over again and erode confidence in our electoral system.
And that's Larry Elder, who's making that claim,
who's a
radio host in LA or some city out in California. He's like Trump. He doesn't come for politics.
No.
There's no penalty for saying everything's rigged in a scam. He'll just go back to sitting behind the microphone. It'll help his ratings.
Yeah.
He pays no penalty for that. Trump paid no penalty for it.
Yep.
Until there's some baseline of accountability, and I don't even know what that looks like anymore, I think that's just something that's going to be baked into the cake now.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, why wouldn't you? You could explain your loss before it even happens. I mean, it's built in at this point.
But it is. And I think it's so deeply frustrating, though, because it allows this, I think, very damaging conspiracy theory to live on and continue to have new life over and over and over again.
Larry Elder's a joke. He's in no way qualified to run the state of California. But there's a part of me, a dark part of me, that wishes it would happen. If somehow Gavin Newsom gets kicked out and Feinstein retires tomorrow, and we get a Republican governor suits us
Well, and great. With Democratic
We've
luck,
done it
you know
all
that
to
would
ourselves.
Happen. I could see that definitely happening. Yeah.
We did it all to ourselves.
Yeah.
We have no one to blame except ourselves, especially Gavin Newsom. Who goes to a $50,000 dinner with
the
health lobby in the health of a pandemic and then is so stupid to allow yourself to be photographed and filmed?
Yeah,
if I'm pulling that move, everybody's giving their phone up and I'm keeping them all night long.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want that to happen. But there is a piece of me that would smile inside to watch the Democrats just melt down on a problem they completely made for themselves.
Right.
God. What do you think of Larry Elder and the chick who threw an egg at him? Did you see that?
I didn't see that. Would that happen at a rally or something?
I think he's walking through Venice Beach or a homeless encampment.
Oh, I did hear that there were people throwing
stuff. A woman
in
a gorilla mask threw an egg at him. That's horrible. And of course, do Democrats say anything about that? No, we don't.
Well, and that's a problem with our politics, right? I mean, it's just we're in this, you know, we ignore what our side does and, you know, and just call out the other side for the same BS.
Brandon, I'm getting to the point where I don't know if there's time to pull back on the stick. It feels like we're a plane 45 angling towards the ground. There's the stick. We just need to pull it back. And we just can't.
I don't
do
see
it.
That happening. And I'm really worried. So this last weekend was the 20th year since 9/11. I hate to say anniversary because that has positive connotations.
Yeah.
But, you know, so a lot to reflect on, especially in conjunction with leaving Afghanistan after a 20-year slog with, you know, just a mixed picture there. But, you know, it's – and then we look at 9/11, which, by the way, for those that didn't see, former President George W. Bush, he gave some really, I thought, solid remarks on 9/11.
Oh, he pissed the light off on that.
Yeah, at Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Yeah. And he tied the events of 1/6 to 9/11 in terms of domestic terrorism with international terrorism and why both are deadly threats to our democracy. Trump responded in kind today to George W. Bush. So it's just, but again, you know, and I think it's great, but I don't think George W. Bush has any authority left in the party because I think it's become the party of Trump now. So I don't know that that'll make a difference.
George Bush gave a very good unity speech.
It was extremely good. Yes.
If it were 1992,
right,
that speech would have been a little hokey, but on point. If it were 1962, I mean, I have to go back even further. That speech was straight out of 1952. I don't know what America he's looking
at.
And for us who was never a fan of G-Dub, this is his main fault. What are you looking at? What America do you see? What unity are you pointing to? If 9/11 happened today, we'd tear each other apart.
Oh, we would. But shouldn't somebody try? And if it's going to be somebody, it should be an ex-president, right? I mean, you look for moral leadership where you can get it. And nobody elected today is providing that,
basically. I agree with
that. So, you know, it's just like I can understand, you know, it's and that's why it's still like it gives me kind of the you know, makes me warm and fuzzy inside when I see the group of ex-presidents without Trump get together.
Yeah.
When I see Obama and Clinton and Bush on the same stage, you know, because there is that idea that, yes, we're supposed to be unified. We can be from different parties, but we all have this commonality. And Trump was the antithesis of that. And so the fact that he has never been part of that ex-president's club now and refuses to be part of it, I think is just emblematic of where we are in the country. Like you said, that there's this line in the sand and, you know, and nobody wants to cross it. But I do give him props because I think that, again, we should have elected Republicans who are drawing that parallel, that comparison between domestic terrorists and international, and it's not being made. But again, I think it's like, you know, shouting, you know, in a forest and nobody can hear you. And this has new significance, too, because this coming Saturday, September 18th, is this Justice for January 6th rally that the crazies...
I didn't know it had a name.
They're calling it Justice for January 6th. So it's part of the narrative to rewrite what happened on January 6th and make the defendants out to be victims and to rally to give them justice and release them from jail. And there's a lot of fear and a lot of intelligence that there could be violence again in the Capitol.
Don't see how it's not.
And I don't know how. Just today, for those that did didn't notice, there was a guy arrested outside of the DNC headquarters with a machete, with a something else.
You said he had a swastika on his truck.
He had a swastika on his truck. Nice. His name has been released. Already has white nationalist neo-Nazi ties outside the DNC. And so with a bayonet, that's the other thing. He had a bayonet and he had a machete. And so, again, this is the precursor to what we could see happen on Saturday. And, you know, the violence we saw on January 6th wasn't an isolated incident. No. It was a culmination of what we've seen the last 4 years, and that hasn't gone away. That's still there.
I appreciate Bush's attempt at the unity.
Yeah.
And what it made me sad for, and where my reaction to it was more about how I felt listening to it than going back and reading it, because I should have felt better.
Yeah.
I should have said, wow, there's an ex-president who I don't agree with from policy wise, but we have some common ground here. And yes, we can. Instead, I walked away from that thinking old, out of date. I don't think that
it's not gonna make a difference
anymore.
Yeah.
And that was more about what it, for me, it's interesting to see how my reaction to those things have shifted from, hey, this is a positive, to this is out of date and I don't know what this is going to do. And why is it always, and you just made this point, why is it always the person who's out of power has to say it?
Yeah.
That's what I don't get either. Why does it always
have to be? Well, that's why
I
think it never resonates, right? Because we don't have anybody in power who's making
that
statement.
Brandon, it's been a pretty depressing podcast. We just came back from vacation. Is there anything fun you're doing or going to do or thinking about doing that can make the ending better?
I might think about that. I don't know. Yeah.
We're in this lull, though. I mean, we've kind of shot our wad for vacations here in the summer. We're kind of in this weird lull stage until Thanksgiving.
I mean, that's the next holiday, right?
Yeah. Halloween. Do you count Halloween as a holiday?
I mean, you don't get it off. It's not a public holiday.
True.
But
true.
You know, I mean, it's something.
Halloween from Spend is the number two holiday, only behind Christmas.
Is it really?
People spend a shit ton on Halloween.
On Halloween. Oh, imagine that.
I used to love Halloween, but we don't get any kids. Nobody trick-or-treats. Everybody goes to the Y and they have some party for kids because I guess it's safer. That makes me depressed.
There's more and more parents that do that. They don't have their kids actually trick-or-treat in the neighborhood, which I understand. But
I get it too.
But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of adults that go to, you know, parties for Halloween and get-togethers. And so that's
Halloween's turned into a mess. I never really got into Halloween.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hate holidays anyway.
I went to a costume party that a former coworker had a couple of years ago that was kind of fun. It was kind of the first like adult Halloween party I've been to.
Always a risk.
Yeah.
When you say adult Halloween party and invite your coworkers, you're just waiting for someone to show up as naughty nurse and be like, oh shit, here we go.
I think there were a couple of those. Yeah. And then a lot of drinking, excessive drinking. So yeah, you get all kinds of.
You're describing something that actually sounds fun.
But I can't imagine, like, I wouldn't ever want to host that, like, at my house. Like, this coworker, she had, like, 50 people at her home, they were all drinking, and I'm like, yeah, that's a big risk. Yeah.
I don't want 50 people in my house for anything.
Yeah.
Especially 50 drunks in your house. You know those people are places they shouldn't be.
Right.
And it's pretty big. How could you put 50 people in the house? That's a lot of people to shove in your house.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess we are coming to summer's going to end and then we're going to slide into the holiday season.
It all happens so fast. That's what I hate. And it's like, and then you get boom. And then January and then just everything kind of slows down.
So Brandon, if the goal here was to end the podcast with something on a highlight, that was not it. The fact we're getting very close to holiday season. I don't count that as our uplifting ending here.
So I did just start watching American Crime Story impeachment. I don't know if you cut the first episode was on last week about the Clinton impeachment trial.
I kind of want to watch that, but I listened to the Slow Burn podcast. I can't see Clinton the same way.
Yeah.
I think if this miniseries does it right, you're going to walk away from this being like, that was not just some quick affair. That was an orchestrated move by him.
And that was the point behind the series, right? Because Monica Lewinsky is actually one of the producers on this series. But it goes to show that the women involved, I mean, Monica, Paula Jones, like all these women were used by everybody around them, sure. Right? I mean, so it shows the Clintons in a negative light and Democrats, but it also shows Republicans who just use them for their own personal gain and for political gain, and how, I mean, just the rampant misogyny that was at play during that time, which is interesting.
The part about this that I didn't know, I thought the Clinton-Lewinsky thing was your typical kind of older man, younger woman, quick meeting, done, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This was a drawn out,
prolonged affair. Yeah.
This is the president of the United States.
Like calling her multiple times at night on the weekends.
Man in the world. Basically trolling someone half his age. It's horrible. And when you dive into that case and you want to know why Trump was able to use Clinton so effectively, Clinton's a pig.
Yeah.
I mean, it is awful. And if she's the one executive producer, they'll do it right and get into it.
And I think they will,
good God.
The other thing that's really fascinating is Sarah Paulson plays Linda Tripp, and she is unrecognizable with the prosthetics and everything. I mean, it's just like blown away.
That is taking a deep dive through Clinton and Lewinsky. It's horrible.
It is, and good. You return to that like in the 90s. It's like, how did we ever go through that time?
At it. At least I did. I thought
it made
it
into
funny.
A joke. And you look at like the reporters, like the questions they were asking and how they went after Monica and laughed about it. It's like they would never get by today acting the way they did back then. Like it's just that would not happen today.
If I owned a big business and I was marketing products to women and I needed a woman to talk, I would try to hire Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Because how that woman in her early 20s made it through that.
Weathered all of that.
She has a strength that very, very few people have.
No kidding.
And in the 90s when that came out, I thought it was funny. I thought it was a joke. Look at Slick Willie. He's at it again. Ha ha. The Republicans hate this. None of it was funny. Yeah. None of it was funny. So
not at all.
All right. I'd ask for one more thing, but I think we're not going to hit it. So I think that's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2 Men in the Middle. We'll see you next week.